voices that pivot and spin around these nodal, shifting points. These blank spaces, silences, or intervals serve as fulcrums for making audible the rhythmic pulse and phrasing being played out, at the same time scissoring the syntax of the language, that is, cutting against the expected breaks of the grammatical phrase or unit of breath. Given these interests, the sound I am laying down is not simply that of a person reading words in any straightforward way, but playing each word as if a note or chord on the piano with slight pauses, creating unexpected spaces between words, allowing phrases to veer off into unexpected sequences of wobbling sound. I no more take for granted how to do this than I assume the syntax or prosody of a poem I am writing. It is a highly constructed, albeit improvised, process based on choosing from a variety of different tonal, rhythmic, and phrasal possibilities. A number of years ago, I was asked to read in the International Sound Poetry Festival in New York, despite the fact that my working style of reading would not normally be considered sound poetry or performance poetry. I prefaced my reading by saying that I thought that there were only two types of poetry, sound poetry and unsound poetry. But now I would change that to sounded poetry and unsounded poetry. It is perhaps a remnant of Romantic ideology that still haunts the performance styles of poetry readings are so often, that performance styles of poetry readings are so often represented in terms of an authentic voicing of the emotions of the unconscious, where effacements of the performative is equated with genuineness of the work, where the acting style is to pretend that there is no acting, where the performance style is to feign that no performing is going on. This, of course, is the story of our everyday lives, where troubling social acts are performed as if without premeditation or self-conscious intent. It's the sort of acting that resembles puppetry. The best, if already dated, symbol of this phenomena is a presidential actor widely praised for his relaxed, natural, I hear this, untheatrical and unrhetorical style. You remember him, probably. Every reading, whether one's own reading of a book or a poet's reading to an audience, is an enactment, a sounding, an embodiment, which is to say, reading that takes or makes time, that enters into the social, material, and historical space of our lives. To deny the performative aspect of poetry is to repress its most literally political dimension, which is to say, how it enters into the world. To deny that rhetoricity or rhetoricalness and theatricality of a poem is to idealize a literary space outside of ideology and history, a zone timeless and blank in which evasion substitutes for the friction of interaction. Yet this friction is the music of our lives. The acknowledgement of the performative dimension of poems is a recognition of their political bearing in the world, fully as much as recognition of the theatricality of each of our social performances is a necessary prerequisite for us to find out how these ingrained habits might be changed or reshaped. For to sound is to give a hearing, and without such forms, we are doomed to endless repetition of sounds we have not ourselves participated in making. Pinky Swear, a nude formalist sonnet. Such mortal slurp to strain this sprawl when drooping. Gazooks, it seems, would bend these slopes in girth. None trailing fail to hear the ship looks loopy, who seen it nailed up tight right at its berth. There's been a luring and a ladling lately that swills the pitch and hiccups faith gone dim. With gumption and such buckle-bursting hurt, alies with pomp paraded, permed and soapy, you'd guess the call was made by that same twerp, destroyed the rig and left you almost dopey. Let days frequent a thought that's soft and gloopy, fluttering like a drill being here and earth, then spin a phrase or spill a toast in verse, such swivel cups the sail of tusk whoopee. So therefore, to sum up, it goes without saying, I can conclude without hesitation as I have argued, but let me restate in no uncertain terms the main points, so that there will be no chance for ambiguity. For it follows from my premises, and you will note have, as you will no doubt have surmised, that all roads have led exactly here and nowhere else. To wit, one of the roles of the poet-critic is to resist the institutionalization or standardization, whether of literary history, or teaching, or writing practices, or speaking. As Tony Crowley points out in his important book, Standard English and the Politics of Language, a standard is both a rallying point for the forward movement of an ideology or group, as a flag in battle, and at the same time a product of normalization and averaging, and historical construction reflecting specific class values. Too often the profession of literary studies, just as the profession of writing, has conflated these two senses of the word, insisting that our standard be normalization of writing practices. Both idiolectical poetry and non-expository criticism bring into view a different set of standards, one that questioned both the neoconservative insistence on transcendental values expressed through the objective and transparent language of rationality, and also the literary sociological movement towards surprisingly uniform styles through which to express the experience of different groups. For writing or reading to assume and consequently express or project a group identity is as problematic as for writing to assume a self or national identity. However, in jettisoning such presumptions, some sense of what such entities might be may be revealed. That is, an attempt to represent an already constituted idea of identity may preclude the possibility of encountering newly emerging identity formations. In this sense, the writing does not escape from its socio-historical situation, but rather contributes to an interrogation and reformulation of the description of the socio-historical situation, foregrounding the heterogeneous and anomalous elements rather than the homogenizing ones. The dangers of dismantling whatever self or group identities we may have already developed is that we risk becoming more atomized, and so more passive. In this state of postmodern paranoia, all collective formations, real or imagined, are ironized or aestheticized, that is, debunked as arbitrary codes, with fashion and market ascendant as the arbiters of value. If social identities are to be made problematic as part of the poetic process, this must be in order to forge new collective identities that will enable more resourceful resistance both to the rigidly territorializing clan, both to rigidly territorializing clannishness and to paralyzingly depoliticizing codicity. The problem is how to be resistant to the reductiveness of all forms of positivism without succumbing to the relativistic erosions of market value that transform poetry from an arena of social exploration or expression to an empty marker of subjectivity in designated free trade zones, to which poet and reader are indeed both subject. That is, to presume a realm of social truths against the one truth of techno-rationality and its schizoid doubles, triumphalist capitalism and religious fundamentalism. Blake remains the greatest emblem of this mental fight in the English poetry traditions, and Blake's active oppositional imagination, I think of Robin Blazer's series, Image Nations, is a vital source for a poetics of resistance. The point is not to display imagination, but to mobilize imaginations. But how can we mobilize imaginations, those imaginary nations, when for the most part, imagination and subjectivity have become house pets of the personal lifestyle industry? Cousins to a creativity that it seems to apply more to earrings than to hearing. This is no doubt Adorno's fear in questioning the historical role of lyric poetry in the wake of a systematic extermination process that shows up all our means of representation as thin, palely inadequate to the realities at hand. For indeed, most conventional verse practice, like most other forms of cultural production, are more the products of an ideological system than any putative author. As a result, they can be read more usefully as cultural symptoms than as the inspired or original works of an autonomous author. However, the current movement of cultural studies risks leveling all art to the status of symptom. And insofar as it does this, it becomes itself the symptom it claims to rise above. Yet poetry can, even if it often doesn't, resist absorption into the zeitgeist. No artist can remain entirely free from collaboration with the society in which she or he works. History is too consuming for that, but relative degrees of resistance are possible. The sort of art I have in mind provides means to which to read its culture, cognitive maps, if you will. New forms provide new methods of critique. Surely the subjectivized, gutted lyric that dominates official verse culture of the U.S. proves Adorno's point. Nonetheless, from the same historical point of view, I would say that poetry is the most necessary form of language practice after the wars. It's worth repeating. Signifying practices have only art from which to copy. Oh no, not art. I thought art was finished, over, done. I mean after Burgo, Danto, and Jameson, and Bourdieu, and all those anthologies of cultural and new historical studies. I mean after the Yale School took Cates out on a TKO. Art's never even been a strong contender. Charlie, it was you. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody, but instead of a bum, which is what I am, let's face it. Art, she's not finished. I can hear her in the very halls we are congregating in today. She's saying, just give me one more chance in the ring.
Get serious about the problem of belatedness, he ought to write about the role of the respondent. It seems to be like the ultimate example of belatedness. I'm supposed to follow that. In the interest of time, since time's getting a little tight, I think I'll cut some of what I was going to talk about. I was going to offer some meditations or generalizations, all of which you will hear are open to argument, in three areas. One had to do with the characterization of the poet critic. In response to Charles's question early in his paper, what is a poet critic? Because I think there are some distinctions that is worth making within that category. The second area that I was going to move around in had to do with the conflict between critical style and content in the academy that Charles raises as a topic. And the third area that I wanted to touch upon has to do with the relationship between institutionalization and innovative writing practices. Of those three, I think I'll drop the questions of characterization, different kinds of poet critic. I'll say briefly that one thing I wanted to do in that discussion is propose or rehabilitate a kind of subcategory that I would call programmatic poet critic. A poet who writes criticism in the interest of promoting a particular poetics, as Rachel suggested last night, to an extent, all poet critics do that. I think it's more or less explicit or implicit in different people's practice. But you go to the programmatic poet critic, I think, for insights about poetics generally, rather than insights simply about their own work. And these are often people affiliated with some kind of avant-garde. And so one issue in their work is often involves promoting values of that avant-garde. I'll rest with that characterization. It's relevant because I'm going to want to get into talking about the question of avant-gardism. And I think you can distinguish what I'm calling the programmatic poet critic from what I might call the occasional poet critic, whom I would characterize as a poet who also writes criticism. And by the occasional poet critic, I mean people like Robert Haas, Dave Smith, most of the people who have published books in the University of Michigan Press series, Poets Talking About Poetry. Seems to me a different kind of work, different sort of category from the more programmatic work that I'm talking about. Let me get to the second issue I want to address, though. This question of the conflict between critical style and content. What Charles calls in his first sentence, the growing discrepancy between our most advanced theories and institutionally encoded prescriptions. Let me say that again. The growing discrepancy between our most advanced theories and institutionally encoded prescriptions on our writing and teaching practices. And perhaps a little riskily, I want to raise that question first in relation to some of Charles's own criticism. In discussing Charles Bernstein's work as a critic and theorist, it's tempting to focus on the marvelous deviations from and expansions and revampings of critical norms in that work. But I'd like to take the hagiography for granted, and in the interest of promoting discussion, focus on a knottier problem. Though not in the paper he delivered today, a point on which Bernstein's criticism in Apoetics and Content's Dream remains somewhat vulnerable, I think, is the very one that he raises at the beginning of his own talk. That is, that its often conventional expository surface contradicts its radically disruptive content. I bring up this issue because it's usually revealing to look both at the connections between critical position and practice in a poet critic's work, in their poetry and in their criticism. So if there's an inconsistency on this point in Bernstein's work, it occurs at the level of style. As I've said, many of his essays stick to the very expository conventions that they flout at the level of content and that his poetry resists. Although those of you who know his work will know that both his poetry and his criticism include examples of passages of their other. That is, the poetry includes criticism, the criticism includes poetry, as you've heard. The rhetoric of a Bernstein essay, at least in the published books, that is, will sometimes conflict with the aesthetics that it proposes. To his credit, Bernstein acknowledges this issue when he admits that one reproduces authoritative critical modes merely by using them, even if only for temporary, local, or strategic purposes. He will frequently take the very conflict or issue that I'm talking about for his subject, and his attitude towards his own use of these conventional critical modes has been ambivalent for a long time, as this comment from a 1983 discussion attests. So this is something he's been working through, I think, for many years. Quote, it seems to me that criticism, rather than trying to establish fixed things which are good for everything, in its best exists at a provisional level, and that provisional quality doesn't need to be masked. But the wrinkle is that masking has social power. If you don't mask it, it doesn't have the impact on an audience. And again, I'm going to be ambivalent about this issue, which is certainly something I should be criticized for. He continues, the problem with expository patterns, but also what accounts for their social force, is that they repress some terms or issues because they are complicated or contradictory or just up. The problem then is that though you may want to resist what he calls in a number of places official critical discourse. Using official critical discourse buys you a certain intellectual access, buys you access to an audience. So it's a very ambivalent position to be in, to be using that rhetoric at the same time as you're in conflict with it. To the extent that it arises not just in official critical discourse, but in the practice of innovative poet critics, the style-content conflict plays out or embodies or reflects, I'm not sure what verb to use, the larger ambivalent relationship of avant-garde to the academy. In his paper today, Bernstein argues that one role of the poet critic is to resist the institutionalization of standardization. But the trick, of course, is to resist institutionalization while being unavoidably a part of it. And that gets me into the third section of what I want to talk about, the question of institutionalization. This has an epigraph from John Ashbery. What we need now is this unlikely challenger pounding on the gates of an amazed castle. That's, I noticed when Charles began his paper that we both ended up with epigraphs involving a challenger, an unlikely challenger in mind, Riddick Berger. Yes. What to make of that, I'm not sure. This is a section from the book that Keith was talking about that deals with the academic reception of language writing. And the discussion involves moving from analyzing the politics of language writing, the old realism as reification argument that was touted in the late 70s, to more of an institutional focus. That is, reading language writing less as political critique, more as institutional critique. That's the kind of background that you might need here. I should also say that in our context here, though I'm going to be talking in the next few minutes about language poetry, in this context here this morning, it stands for most innovative writing practices, insofar as the same set of issues come up for innovative writers not affiliated with language writing. Rachel Blauvin-Plessy and Nate Mackett. I don't mean to subsume them into the rubric of language writing, but if you can take language writing as standing for sort of larger set of practices here. So as regards the move from the political to the institutional, justification for this position, which I see not as a move away from the political so much as a move towards a particular form of it, can be found in an essay that's been central for many language writers, Louis Althusser's Ideology and Ideological State Apparatuses. For Althusser, the function of ideology is to interpolate or socially constitute individuals as subjects. Practically speaking, in his words, quote, ideologies are realized in institutions, in their rituals and their practices, in the ISAs, his acronym for Ideological State Apparatus. He argues that educational institutions are the dominant ideological state apparatus of our time. The ways in which the university, as one part of the educational ISA, interpolates subjects, however, can be contested within the institution. For any ISA is a site of class struggle and competing discourses. For a theorist such as Althusser, then, the problem becomes this. From within ideology, we have to outline a discourse which tries to break with ideology. The question there, of course, as Audre Lorde will put it, is whether the master's tools can dismantle the master's house. In her view, they can. Althusser is looking for a way that they might be able to. Similarly, from within what Ron Silliman calls the inescapable mediating institution governing American poetry, the academy, language writing seeks to outline a discourse that breaks with the dominant discourses of that institution. For Bernstein, quote, resisting the institutionalization of interpretation is a motivation for both poetics and poetry, unquote. That's from A Poetics, but it echoes something he said this morning. But the sites of that resistance, if it is to make a difference, must include the institution itself. As Bernstein himself implicitly acknowledges by making this argument first in the pages of Critical Inquiry and then in a book published by Harvard University Press. Institutional interventions have their risks, of course. The skeptic might see Bernstein's and Susan Howe's appearance in American Poetry Review, the increased visibility of language writing in scholarly journals and conference programs, the occasional academic job, the publication of Apoetics with Harvard University Press. The skeptic might see all this as signs of co-option. And I won't run down the litany of further possible examples. Not surprisingly, some writers within the language community have objected to what Ron Silliman calls, quote, the shifting from the canonical to the institutional strategy, unquote. By which, he means a shift from discussing canons in terms of who is in and who is out, to discussing their institutional basis and attempting to make institutional interventions. Responding to Silliman's fall 1988 talk at the New School for Social Research, Alan Davis says, quote, I see you institutionalizing yourself as you think and as you communicate in the way that you do, as you generate ideas in the way that you do, and as you present them in this place to this body of people, and I don't like to see that happen, unquote. Similarly, Andrew Levy questioned, quote, or asked this question, what is the value or efficacy of the kind of exposition that you're using tonight? So much of the theoretical writing that is being published in different public forums, such as your collaborative piece in Social Text, is basically very traditional discursive essays. It's the same style that you can read almost anywhere. It's just that the subject is different. These comments address what Bernstein also notes as the risk involved in adopting institutional discourses. Quote, insofar as you seize these authoritative modes, you become them. There's no way to use them without reproducing them. So it's always an ambivalent thing, and I don't think it's possible not to err when you do this. You err on the side of power. Silliman justifies his approach by an appeal to an audience that he sees as either academic or at least theoretically informed, or both. The basis for Davis's and Levy's response is style. To argue for an anti-institutional poetics in an institutionalized discourse is to undercut oneself from the beginning. Silliman himself, an articulate proponent of oppositional institutional strategies, but also a self-confessed skeptic, asks, quote, if the integration of poets into the academy is interpreted as the loss of critical oppositionality, and at the same time the university system is perceived to be far more of a dominant social agent than it was just 20 years ago, what is to prevent language poetry from going into the kind of terminal blue funk that characterized the later Frankfurt School? Unquote. Good question. One could answer, nothing. But one could also argue that the next step after establishing a set of counter-institutions is to go beyond preaching to the converted and intervene in mainstream institutions. Bernstein, for instance, is aware that any group, including the language writers, is susceptible to commodification. Quote, group, family, aesthetic, social, national, is merely another part of our commoditized lives, but we consume these formations along with most other things as commodities and are ourselves consumed in the process. Names become packages through which a commodity is born. Barrett Watton, commenting on Language magazine, puts it succinctly. The radical poetics of language are mediated by the common sense functionalism of a professional role. Perhaps this is symptomatic of a cultural fact, that the intellectual is himself commoditized by the university system. In this situation, the goal for any avant-garde, or for someone interested in reinventing the poet critic, becomes not to avoid commodification or institutionalization, so much as to use it. Andrew Ross puts the success of language writing most accurately then, when he observes that, quote, the achievement of these writing practices is that they are making an art of the constantly assimilated position in which they find themselves, unquote. All avant-garde become assimilated to some degree. Roland Barthes defines the avant-garde as that rested language which is going to be recuperated. Paradoxically, language writing may gain its ideological impact and its long-term effects on American poetry out of its very assimilation into the institutions that govern poetry. Quote from Ron Silliman. The primary ideological message of poetry lies not in its explicit content, political though that may be, but in the attitude towards reception it demands of the reader. It is this attitude towards information which is carried forward by the recipient, It is this attitude which forms the basis for a response to other information, not necessarily literary, in the text, and beyond the poem, in the world. An institutionalized aesthetics is one mechanism for the interpolation of subjects, which is why an aesthetics has ideological implications. The institutions of American poetry, that is, like any other social institution, shape social subjects, make a certain range of subject positions or attitudes towards information possible and available. As a complicating presence within these institutions, language poetry seeks to affect how the ideological state apparatuses mediating American poetry shape poetry readers as social subjects. It seeks to broaden the range and nature of subject positions the American poetry establishment makes available. However, this effect will have to be achieved within, even while in conflict with, the governing institutions of American poetry. This is why in her 1987 book of poems, Tabula Rosa, Rachel Blaudy Blessee writes, "If the laws of language are sociological laws, then poetry is provisionally complicit resistance." These lines capture nicely the ambivalent relationship of experimental writing to the canons and institutions of contemporary poetry. A resistance whose complicity, or whose resistance, is only provisional. Complicit resistance is only a provisional, contingent definition of a poetry that tries to stay one step ahead of canonizing institutions, or perhaps, to adapt Frank O'Hara, a step away from them. The situation of American poetry today is such that language writing, more than any earlier avant-garde, has been forced to address its complicity with the canon-making institutions that it would reshape, and a number of poets have folded that address effectively into their work. To return to my epigraph from Ashbery, today the unlikely challenger has to pound from within the gates of the amazed castle. Thanks.
I'd like to keep this to about 15 or 20 minutes. In particular, since we're running late, and since you'll also have a chance to talk to Charles in small groups, and all of us tomorrow at the panel discussion, which I hope you remember. But I'll point questions at either Charles or Alan.
Rachel Duplessis does and so on, is for me very important. So while I would say, you know, I see other things other than what Dan Zinor advocates as being possible, I think that from the point of view like Alan was talking about, institutional critique, even one powerful critique that has a broad-based, you know, acceptance is useful. And I'm very interested in that happening. But I actually think that even the people who are putting that forward to some degree, getting personal, are in fact dealing with a much wider range of openings of practices. And that it's their way, they can do this, and this is a frame which is an acceptable alternative, and it actually stands for a whole lot of other things. And that was another thing about what Christian said, I guess, very much, for wanting to use that very important to her own book to move further so that it not be allowed as a narrow thing, but to make it into a more multi-spectral.
This is a very big question. I was fascinated by the focus on political in both the talk last night and this morning. It seemed that when you were pressed last night, you picked on the word rhetoric as sort of, you had to have a word for an oppositional discourse which insisted upon the social community and so forth. And it seemed in the climax when you said phrase, Charles Henke focused on this word art, you know, no one on art. And I wondered if either of you would like to talk about the relationship of those two as sort of terms for a kind of oppositional discourse at this particular moment. Rhetoric versus art, rhetoric and art, or art and rhetoric, whatever.
Yeah,
the question that I asked in my paper was whether one should call it rhetoricality or
rhetoricity.
I wasn't sure I hope you were going
to
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think, again, that's a place where Rachel and I agree with this kind of provisional argument. Unlike Rachel, I actually can only answer questions in a strict philosophical sense. So I
You don't do
both. I only do, you know, philosophy at its highest level. From that point of view, I would answer at its highest level that, in fact, you know, a way that you can understand what I'm saying, and I think also Rachel's saying, is as a countermeasure to a kind of use of rhetoric in this bad sense. And I think it does relate to the dynamics of Alan's. My interest in that is probably emphasized as a use, and it also links up to many other things that where people would strongly disagree with many of my positions, but the idea of the constructed nature of the discourse, whether it be poetic or not, and not have this idea of poetry, again, related to Rachel said, as something on high, and then this other stuff as something worth faith. Or on the other hand, this kind of theory of something that's like master text that flies over everything. So rhetorical, and then, it's very much the rhetorical relates to the, you know, great, for me, fundamental work in this context of Oscar Wilde, the greatest artist, which is absolutely fundamental. You know, text from the dialogue in there and so on, which he says famously that art is not copyright, but life copies art, in which I echo signifying practices, which I take to be the term, certain term for cultural studies, but this thing that's not literature has only art from which to copy. That's a kind of a rephrase of Wilde's thinking there. And also in Soul and the Socialist, because I think Wilde is, you know, remains to me somebody who's thinking through those questions. So.
Do I have to tell Charles? Always a big thing. I think that the way that a person gets phrased in this situation is complicated by the fact that you're taking one word from Charles and one word from me and you're trying to match them. And I would prefer to kind of go back to the density of the context from which these words come. I mean, for me, rhetoric, you know, to talk about rhetoric is kind of situated social speech and a kind of practice that comes out of that. So that's the way that I think of it. I have no quarrel with what Charles thinks about it, or I think that one of the biggest distinctions between us, if we're matching, you know, here as the first speakers, is that I my poetics comes from and is not indebted to a poetic sincerity that, of course, would be quite a poorly critique. be quite a wildly important listener. Yeah, because I come from Auckland in a certain sense. I grew up very heavily on Auckland. So, you know, from that point of view, when I use the word rhetoric, I'm less of a trickster figure than when Charles used the word art.
I will say about rhetoric, by the way, that rhetoric as a term to me, the term of art, rhetoric as a term of art, very much touches on the issue that Alan raises. I mean, the term itself has the ambiguity. On the one hand, it suggests this kind of possibility of constructiveness and perhaps even intentionality. But on the other hand, it also suggests persuasion, which suggests repression of a certain sort for a particular point. And I think Alan raised the problems of that quite right, quite, you know, quite thoughtfully in respect to what I do. And so one of the reasons I'm attracted to rhetoric is that the term itself, its history, suggests the very problem, which is a Rachel way that Alan addressed.
Some 10 years ago, I heard you give a great critique of Terry Eagleton's literary theory when it first came out, and I also associate him with the ending up, in a certain sense, with a version of rhetoric as a way of looking at oppositional discourse.
Your question about art raises some interesting historical issues. Self-critic, I think, that, or actually part of what I brought there at the beginning. Bob von Helberg has written one of the definitive few available essays on self-critic, which you probably know, and talks in that essay, makes a distinction in that essay between a time that is the new critical moment, when the most influential critics were poets and started as poets, and the more recent the post-war period, essentially, where the most influential critics have not been poets. Now, my peers here will probably kill me for saying this, but what that suggests to me is a kind of bizarre analogy between the new critical moment and our current moment, because what I think you have now is a generation of what I call programmatic poet critics. Turning to art as a possible model for the writing of criticism in the same way that the new critics did, who were a generation of all men, obviously, who started as poets, who had a kind of ambivalent relationship to the academy, but felt that was where the work had to be done. I think there's some general unlikely connection between those two moments.
But the essential difference, I think, is in what we call, you know, the passage into post-structuralism, because at the proprieties and the sense of decorum that operated in that generation, the critical generation, would never have thought to raise the sorts of questions that are being raised at a conference like this, which involve, to use a convenient term, the blurring or the attack upon generic boundaries, whereas today what seems to be foremost in our minds is the potential that lies within the blurring of those very boundaries. And it's just not getting so far here.
Yeah, I tried to just have one paragraph about that. By no means am I wanting to dismiss that issue, but I try to emphasize actually the opposite, although, you know, not in any detail. But that is to say, lots of what I was saying today, I'm emphasizing generically. What I was criticizing is a kind of undifferentiated prose that goes as a kind of boilerplate, you know, copy-edited style in different contexts. And of course, I've worked with commercial writers. I've written, you know, in my life before being whatever it is that I am now. So, in a certain way, I mean, it's like rhetoric, which, as you say, has a lot of problems with most of the way we use it. In a similar way, genre, I would have some problems with, I'm sure, as it's practiced. But even so, in genre, Jeb Azulu writing a fantastic piece of language years ago about the relation of the etymology of the genre to race, to group, and so on. And it's a kind of a disturbing quality of the genre. And on the other hand, part of it, a way to interpret what I'm saying, which is simply that if one understands prose as a genre, there are different genres of prose, there are different genres of nonfiction prose. And, you know, even intercutting, even what I'm saying, my quality of this module, could be interpreted as a genre. So it's not, you know, I am myself in my practice interested in blurring perhaps or other words for it than that, but mixing together or juxtaposing different genres, that's certainly true. But I'm not sure that M is the blurred genres only. Sometimes it creates a synthesis, which is a third thing, but also sometimes it actually activates some awareness of the different genre qualities that you're talking about, and that both of those effects.
I'm
going to
Alan, and just ask him whether, you know, what you were talking about in terms of poet critics, it seems to me that you're moving starkly across the front. What I think of as the originating moment in the modernism of the poet critic really comes as the work of John Eliot, you know, very little there, which had its secret shadow in the work of Marion Moore, Richard Stein, and H.D., who Marion Moore and Stein wrote quite a number of essays. H.D. Did not, but she wrote a kind of strange essayistic prose later in Tribute to Freud, that, like, you know, but we're talking about the 20s, teens in the 20s.